This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Thank you very much, Margot, and everybody for being here. I'm going to zoom out a little bit on this after hearing Chris's very personal insights into Emily Nrais, and I have to get. I think we should. There've been a number recently of revisions of the spelling of the name of Emily, and I think instead of the spelling, we really should have language lessons. Something that I've grappled with, and I've noticed all sorts of people in the last day or so have grappled with this with the saying. The family have often tried to teach me how to say it, Ungrai, properly. I'm getting close to it, but I think that's probably still wrong too. I'm not sure that it matters, but it is one of those things that I think shows us a distance and perhaps the mystique where Aboriginal people have and artists are seen in one part of the universe and we viewers are seen in another part. My own background has been that I've been very close to artists all my life. I'm not an artist. This is a bit like John Mundine's disclaimer. I'm not an artist. I'm not an anthropologist. I'm not an Aboriginal person. But I've been very close to many of Australia's most famous artists and international artists all my life. My father was an artist and an art critic. My mother was similarly interested in art. My daughter and I still work in a studio built by Arthur Boyd. And just to sort of backtrack a little bit to something that Janet Holmes-Accord has been raising in the last couple of days about taking Aboriginal or putting this exhibition into New York. In the 1960s, some of my earliest recollections about Aboriginal art were from, obviously, my parental background. My dad, in 1965, took an exhibition of Bach art to America and placed it not in an ethnographic context, but in the fine art context. The director of the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston at the time, in 1965, was James Johnson Sweeney, who had been one of the, I think, the second director of the Guggenheim in New York. And I was thinking that the two of them, I remember these discussions, and Carol Kupka, who was an artist and a collector of Aboriginal art for what is now the Musée de Quai Branly in Paris, was very instrumental in this as well, and the discussions about art not being seen in an ethnographic context, and they were all very passionately convinced, way back in the 60s, that Aboriginal art should be seen in this broader fine art context. So I think that, you know, maybe, Janet, we need another J.M.J. Sweeney to take the Emily exhibition to New York. Zooming out a little bit about Emily's place in Australian art, in 1999, I was the visual arts writer for The Australian, and one of those things that happens in journalism is that within about, you know, a week or something, someone said, oh, it's the end of the millennium, we need a piece, please, on who are Australia's most significant artists for the last 100 years. Easy task. And I quickly went through the list of, you know, possible hundreds of artists. I came up with, I think these were the ones that I chose, Arthur Streeton, Sidney Nolan, Arthur Boyd, John Brack, Fred Williams, Brett Whiteley, Johnny Warren Caller-Juparula, Rosalie Gascoigne, Rover Thomas, and Emily Ungrai. I chose those artists because not because there were not many, many other contenders for that incredibly concise view of Australian art, because to me those artists had changed our ways of seeing, and I think that that is fundamentally significant in judging the or surveying the significance of an artist through in a broader perspective. And certainly Emily, it got me thinking in those years about what her position had been and how she would be viewed historically. It was after the first Emily show that Margot had done in Queensland, but I felt that particularly Rover Thomas and Emily had taken Aboriginal art into new dimensions that would be seen, and as has come to pass, so they've actually influenced a whole generation of Aboriginal artists, whether consciously or unconsciously. I don't know that there's so much consciousness going on, but certainly her art was a stylistic breakthrough, which with Thomas was something that broke the mould of what we'd perceived or what was perceived as Aboriginal art. So I think that is her significant legacy in a broader perspective. Going back a bit more to my own engagement with and observation of Emily's work and the Utopia Lands, I didn't know her as have many other people, people who worked with her, as Chris was talking about, himself and Rodney Gooch, the late Rodney Gooch, Jenny Green, and others from those early 80s batik days. However, I first went to Utopia in about 1992, and at Donald and Janet Holt's place, which is not actually Utopia, the station next to Utopia, Delmore Downs. Emily was not there, but she was called over, I suppose, or that she'd heard that the number of people were there, and she came over and she was painting on the veranda. And I, too, was struck by this extraordinary ability that she had to take a great range of colours, this huge number of colours, and it looked like a total muddy mess. And I thought, how is anything going to emerge from this? And the sheer energy of her hand as she painted, I've often equated it to the pounding of a clove of garlic, because she really would pound very strongly. This picture behind me here has been the cover of our book since its first edition, which was also in 1999, a Penny Tweedy photo. Penny had quite a long engagement with the Utopia community and is a wonderful photographer in Aboriginal societies, and manages to bring to her photographs an engagement that is quite something that we don't really understand why, but her works, her photographs have a certain emotional quality, because she spends time with people. People clearly love her and respect her and are able to work with her. And I think that this image of Penny's shows Emily's hand and its strength. She was a camel lady and a very strong person, little but very strong, and the way that she would paint with both hands, and as Chris has said, the ability to start off in one part of a canvas and continue it all the way through was quite extraordinary. So my own awareness of, or personal knowledge of her, was from those years, and seeing her paint, and then more, it was as an industry commentator. During the 1990s, by sheer virtue, I think, of having been around art for so many years and knowing so many stories of art and so many stories behind the scenes of art, I started writing those scenes and putting them in the public dimension for The Australian. And it was a period when Emily's, I think, rise to fame, as we say in the Encyclopedia of Australian Art, was so great and so quick that it was too quick to assess at the time. We've written that within 4 years from her first exhibition, she'd achieved a fame and demand for her work few artists achieve in a lifetime's practice. And that is really quite something. Media coverage was intense. And while Ungerai herself often proved an elusive subject, her story continued to be spread and her paintings always surprised. As Chris has mentioned, the surprise in her paintings, the new styles, were one of the fundamentally significant things about her position as a long-lasting, an artist of great significance. Most impressive also, given the demand, the commercial demands, was that she would paint different painting styles for different people. And I think that showed her business ability, because it was a commercial, often, decision to paint certain things for certain people, and that's exactly what she did. She worked with many dozens of dealers. Rodney Gooch and Christopher Hodges were the first, and along with Gabriel Pitsey, to bring her work into the public dimension. Also, we cannot ignore Don and Janet Holt from Delmore Downs, Michael Hollow of the Alice Springs Desert Art Gallery, most particularly her adopted grandson, Fred Torres, who is the son of Barbara Weir, who, and Barbara and Emily's story is a complex and the subject of a whole other discussion and exhibition, indeed. They supplied works to the expatriate Adelaide dealer Robert Steele and Hank Eaves. Both Eaves, Gabriel Pitsey, Melbourne Flinders Lane Gallery, Sonia Heitlinger, Savar of Sydney, many others spent time with her at the Utopia lands she rarely left. She also, of course, sold works to a huge number of other dealers and people around at the time. Her works did become the subject of speculation about fakes by copyists and those by members of her community whose works were passed off as being by her. However, I think the thing that was supreme about Emily was that neither she nor her art was compromised or reduced by these highly fraught issues. And they were fraught issues. They're very great demand on Aboriginal artists to produce art, to help communities, to fund all sorts of people and all sorts of projects. And the fact that this elderly woman was able to withstand these pressures and continue not only to sell works to support much of her wider community, but to continue to develop stylistically, was, as those who knew her, characteristic of both herself, but also of the power of great art and the spirits which guide it. I wasn't really going to talk so much about this issue, but there was a piece in the Canberra Times just recently, and I thought, oh, here it comes again. We all want to get rid of, me included, the issue of fakes and frauds and so forth. However, it continues to pop up whenever there's an exhibition. And I have to say that in Indigenous art, it's an issue, but I think it's really completely rather out of context, because whenever there's a demand for art, wherever demand exceeds supply, there's a parallel industry of fakes and frauds and all sorts of bad dealings that go on. We subscribe to the International Art newspaper online, and every week I sort of don't want to open it in my email inbox, because it's all about fakes and frauds and scams and people in museums ripping off other things, and, you know, the entire art world could be seen to be in this rather jaundiced way, full of this, and it hasn't diminished. I mean, there was, in the 80s, there was an enormous school of fake impressionist, Australian impressionist artists, and yet we don't go, oh, Arthur Streeton must be, you know, should we query every work in an exhibition, in a retrospective exhibition, because there have been this school of fakes that have dogged really all of successful artists. And it is the responsibility, and why we have exhibitions such as retrospective exhibitions, to sort the wheat from the chaff, really, and say that, look, all those things exist, but what has been distilled and presented here is legitimate and selected and carefully thought out art. So I was rather curious to see in the Canberra Times by art critic Sasha Grishin, quoted, and, you know, I hope he was quoted correctly. He says there's some spectacular work here, but he also says that Emily's work has been incredibly well promoted. Well, that's so of any artist. I mean, any artist who has an exhibition in a public gallery, one would hope that their work would be well promoted. It shouldn't be seen as a negative thing. We have to promote art in order for people to come and see it. So it seems to me, you know, a slight sort of slur to say, well, it only exists because it's been well promoted. I can't for one minute imagine that was so, and maybe he didn't even intend to say that, but that's what was written. Although he did go on to say that there have been a galaxy of accomplished artists, Clifford Possum Chabaljari, Rover Thomas, George Milpururu, it's supposed to be, and David Malangi. And they're all seen as worthy of as much attention. Well, in fact, Clifford Possum has already had a retrospective. Rover Thomas has already had a retrospective. Rover Thomas was in the Venice Biennale. There's been many, many things that have been worthy of attention in all of those artists' work. And the article goes on to talk about some of the origins of Emily's work, and things become murky. And it's nothing new, really, in this. I think it's hit the news again because there have been some recent newspaper articles. There was a Four Corners program a little while ago, which was a very confused program, I thought, about which confused the auction process with white auction process with Indigenous art, and I think it just did more to confuse than explain anything. However, there are some figures talked about that there are allegedly 5,000 works of Emily's around, and only 3,000 are legitimate. Well, you know, as Christopher Hodges has said, there were all sorts of family works and white copyists and all sorts of people paintings that were passed off as Emily's painting. So I think that, you know, if there's any questions that we would like to talk about, maybe as a result of that, I'm very happy to give my views on them. Emily's significance. In the latest edition of Contemporary Aboriginal Art, which is coming out next month, we've found it hard, first of all, two things. We've this cover image, which is from 1994. We chose for the cover of the 1999 edition of that book, and for anybody who knows about publishing procedure, it's very—it's almost a given that you have to choose a different cover for new editions of books. And we went around the world and back again, really, because we couldn't find a better image that summed up what our book is all about, which is not just Utopia and Emily, but it's all of Australian Indigenous art. Nine regions this book covers and some 80 art communities and places. And still, this image spoke to us most clearly as being representative of both this book and the great quality of Indigenous art. And that an image from 1994 could still look radical in 2008, I think really speaks of the significance of both her art and the photographer and her image making. Within the Utopia region, I think that Emily's, by example, enabled a flowering of a new generation of artists. When she died in 1996, I was the only media representative fortunate enough, or, well, in a sad way, to be asked to go to one of the memorial services at Utopia for her. And it was a pretty extraordinary day. It was a day full of tensions and sadness and many, many emotions. Most extraordinary day. But after that period, it was as though the community was in a deep period of mourning. There was a lot of commercial pressure to come up with another Emily. You know, there were a lot of people running around saying, let's find another Emily, because obviously there was a gap left for financial and all sorts of other reasons. And that didn't happen as it really shouldn't. It's not something that you can create. It's something that has to evolve organically. Some years later, there have been so many. Utopia is not one place. It's a number of small homeland communities, each of which has their own very particular style and artists who've been hugely significant. Gloria Pajara is here, and Gloria is a major and wonderful artist. Barbara Weir, there's some 200 or 300 artists from the Utopia region. So to try to look at it in one view is just not possible. However, I have to say that an artist whose work many years later, after Emily's death, not many, it wasn't all that many years later, it seems like many years later, 3 or 4 years later, Minnie Puller started with a workshop, and who'd been observing the art of Emily for years and never painted, asked for paints and started to paint, and she was another late blooming genius whose work has been compared to Emily's, but there is a superficial resemblance in body painting and obviously some of the structures of and styles. However, they painted from very different countries and very different stories. So her impact on the Utopia region was very significant both at the time and since. And I think in the broader Australian context, I sort of feel that even though through this exhibition, I still feel like we're not at the beginning of it, but we're certainly at a part of the journey along the way, because I just feel that I'm amazed that people are still, and maybe it's just new generations, which is what happens. We're still seeing this work and having it introduced to us, and there are new questions that come up, and there are new issues, and there's new engagement and new interpretations and new writing on it, and I think that this will continue. So I can see her position just growing. It was in the previous retrospective, it was huge, and then it perhaps died down a bit, and now with this exhibition, it's clearly achieving a position that will only increase. And I think that that will be something that maybe in 10 years' time we'll have yet another exhibition, a different exhibition. Maybe every 10 years you should do one, Margot, a sort of Emily through the ages, and it can grow. I don't know how many, we go on. And I have to say, it's what an inspiration. This woman was in her 80s when she started painting. Hey, we're only just starting. So thank you very much.
Dick Aitken. Susan, to what extent do you think Emily has had an influence, a discernible influence, outside of the utopia area and community? For instance, has she had a discernible influence in other Central Australian Aboriginal communities, Panya, for instance, or Yundamu, or wherever?
Has she had a discernible influence? Well, yes and no. I think that because Aboriginal art is not, it's very much based on people's own stories and people's own representations of those stories. It's not the sort of thing that's necessarily influenced. I think what her influence was more subtle, in that, for a start, colourism and the gestural nature of her work. I think that has had an indirect influence, possibly, on not just Indigenous artists either. I think it's enabled a whole lot of non-Indigenous artists to re-look at the notion of abstractionism or expression and abstract expressionism. So it's certainly the use of colour is one thing that you could say has been influential, or it's sort of enabled people to break free somehow and to move into different colourful expressions, whereas perhaps before it had been a lot more, certainly the Papunya school, who had consciously decided, on and off, but mainly consciously decided to stick to earth tones in their paintings, and pretty much do still, but in other areas it really broke that sort of mould in the public perception as well as the artistic communities.
On a recent trip to Alice Springs after many years' absence and to Yundamu, I spent quite a bit of time looking through the galleries, and what you said about colour, I felt very much the same thing. There is a real breakthrough from other communities as well. If you look back historically to, say, 10 or 15 years ago, and I'm just wondering, and I've got a very good feeling that she and perhaps Minnie have had quite an influence outside of their own community. That's all, really.
I agree.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.